Welcome to another deep dive. This is where we take the material you send our way. Could be articles, notes, sometimes even whole books. And, well, we really try to dig in.
Yeah, we pull out the main arguments, the interesting bits, and try to give you the core insights without you having to wade through everything.
And today, we're looking at a really interesting source you provided, the General's book.
Right. And the title itself is pretty striking, Il Mondo al Contrario. The world upside down. That really sets the stage for the whole theme.
It does. The introduction lays it out, this feeling that, you know, what's often sold as progress just feels off. Counter to common sense, maybe,
yeah.
Or traditional values.
Exactly. It taps into that sense of things feeling fundamentally backwards, maybe even alienating for some people.
A feeling like the world's gone a bit topsy-turvy. And the author's pretty clear about his aim here, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He states up front he wants to voice what he calls a silent majority. And crucially, he says he's basing his arguments on objective truth, data, facts, not feelings or subjective takes.
Trying to ground it in something solid from his perspective.
That's the idea. Presenting a viewpoint he clearly feels doesn't get enough airtime.
Okay, so let's start unpacking this world upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 1 seems to kick things off with this idea of common sense being, well, under siege.
Yeah, that's central. The book basically frames common sense as the direct opposite of this mondo al contrario. It suggests that normalita, you know, normality, has somehow become almost a negative term.
Replaced by what? Extreme subjectivity.
That seems to be the argument. That if everything boils down to my personal perception, then any shared sense of what's normal or common sense sort of loses its footing. Maybe it's even seen as undesirable.
Right. And this then connects to his points about censorship.
It does. He argues it's not just, like, legal bans. It's more subtle, more pervasive, happening through media, social platforms.
You mean how he describes platforms kind of purging speech they find inconvenient?
Exactly. He brings up examples like Facebook suspensions, Twitter banning Trump, arguing these are big platforms making unilateral calls on who gets heard, effectively shaping the public conversation.
And political correctness fits into this picture, too, according to the book.
Very much so. His argument is that this drive for inclusivity creates pressure to avoid any language that might cause even a perceived disadvantage for a minority group.
He gives examples, right?
Yeah, things like parent one instead of dad, or saying happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas. He also dives into the debates around gendered job titles in Italian, like soldatessa for a female soldier, questioning why the push isn't consistent for all words.
So the book's concern seems to be that prioritizing minority views over, well, what he calls majority common sense, might create a distorted picture of society. Maybe one that feels more modern, but less true to lived reality for many.
That's the core of it, yeah. He suggests a kind of paradox in democracy where trying to respect minorities, in his view, has somehow led to minorities overpowering the majority through these imposed rules of tolerance.
Okay, let's shift from social norms to something bigger, maybe national identity. Chapter 4 tackles multiculturalism.
Right, and it starts with that Samuel Huntington quote, basically asking, how can a country made up of different civilizations, maybe belonging to none fully, actually stick together?
The author shares a personal anecdote, too, about Paris.
He does. Recalls being a kid there, initially curious about people of color, but that faded. What didn't fade was his strong sense of being distinctly Italian, different from the French culture around him. That personal identity seems key to his argument.
Which then feeds into his point about common values being vital for national defense.
Precisely. The book asks, you know, what really motivates soldiers? Is it defending abstract, differentiated rights? Or is it defending shared values, family, traditions, a connection to their land and their people? The argument is that deeper connection is fundamental.
The book also makes a pretty stark historical point about coexistence.
Yeah, it argues that historically, peaceful coexistence between very different groups often needed one of two things. Either one group clearly dominating, or a really strong state, sometimes authoritarian, enforcing one set of rules for everyone.
He needs examples.
He does. Cites figures like Siad Barre in Somalia, Tito in Yugoslavia, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, suggesting they're strong, maybe heavy-handed rule was what kept diverse groups from conflict, even if the rule itself wasn't ideal.
And then the book kind of zooms around the world looking at immigration policies, contrasting them with what he sees in Europe.
Right. He points to places like Malta, Japan, Australia, describing them as having strict controls, quick removals for irregular entry, but also, importantly, high human rights rankings. He mentions the U.S. continuing expulsions, Russia having little irregular migration because, he argues, the system is clear. Authorization first, then jobs and housing, with strict consequences for breaking rules.
So the takeaway from the book is that migration isn't just some unstoppable force.
That's his position, definitely. It depends heavily on policy choices. He argues if policies like unconditional acceptance are seen as harmful, well, they should be changed. He even floats the idea of flipping the burden of proof for asylum, making the applicant prove their case, not just the state disprove it.
And he also criticizes what he sees as preferential treatment within the system.
Yes, the book brings up using LGBTQ plus status for asylum claims and points to things like specific housing initiatives in Rome for LGBTQ plus immigrants. The author argues this creates a sort of hierarchy, a series A and B among people needing help.
Okay, let's pivot from national identity to something really personal security. Chapter 5, self-defense, kicks off with a basic need, right?
Maslow's hierarchy, yeah. Security right up there after basic survival. And he contrasts the feeling of safety or the certainty of punishment in other places with what he describes in Italy.
Like that German police story.
That's a striking one. Police stopping joggers just because they looked out of place near a house, checking IDs. He contrasts that kind of proactive policing and perceived certainty of consequences with feeling less secure or seeing less follow-through in Italy. Sites feeling safer, leaving doors unlocked in places like Greece or Turkey.
And the book is quite critical of the Italian legal system's handling of certain crimes, like theft.
Very critical. He uses the term bagatelle, treating it as trifling. He points to a specific legal concept, particolare tenuità del fatto, the slightness of the act, being used to acquit in some theft cases. He links this to high theft statistics versus a personal sense that crime often goes unpunished. The argument is the system lacks deterrent.
Which leads right into the really sensitive ground of self-defense.
Yeah, this is where the book strongly pushes back against anti-weapon arguments. It delves into the right to use force, even lethal force, if your home is invaded. It asks, what's the alternative for an ordinary person facing violent intruders, especially with family there? What are you supposed to do? Just give up everything and hope.
He really stresses the importance of the home in Italian culture, too.
Absolutely. La casa, the home. It's framed as more than just property. It's a pillar of life, security, family. And the book argues, kind of paradoxically, that the legal system sometimes seems to protect squatters or thieves more than the actual homeowners.
Okay, shifting from home security to planetary security, I suppose. Chapter 6 critiques environmentalism.
Right. The book's stance seems to be that a lot of current environmental policies are more ideological than practical or effective. He specifically goes after some EU directives.
Like the 2035 ban on combustion engines, the Green Homes energy efficiency rules.
Those are key targets. The book challenges their global impact versus the cost. It throws out data points. The whole EU is about 7.3% of global CO2. Transport within that is maybe 1.4%, housing less than 1% globally.
So the argument is, even if Europe meets these targets, it barely moves the needle globally.
That's the core argument, that these policies won't make a huge difference worldwide, but will impose massive costs on European citizens and industries.
And the economic critique goes beyond just the price tag.
It does. The book cites figures like $1.2 trillion for the car industry's EV transition by 2030, points out practical issues with EVs, like long-distance charging, argues old cars will just get exported and pollute elsewhere, and the cost for homeowners to upgrade insulation, heating systems that's highlighted as a huge burden.
He also makes that interesting point that economic decline might actually be worse for the environment.
That's a key part of his argument, that poorer countries have to prioritize basic needs and economic growth over expensive green tech. They just can't afford it. So environmental protection, in this view, actually relies on economic prosperity.
And what's the book's take on nuclear energy?
Despite public resistance in some areas, the book frames nuclear as proven, safe, and economical. It points out it's now in the EU's green taxonomy. Cites Finland's experience with their new reactor, Olkiluoto 3, apparently bringing down electricity prices significantly. The argument is that nuclear provides the reliable, affordable base power needed for any realistic energy transition.
Okay, moving into another really charged area. Chapter 9, the LGBTQ plus planet.
Yeah, and the author flags this right away, saying he was warned off the topic. It shows how contentious it is. He offers a quick historical look, contrasting some ancient tolerance with medieval persecution, before diving into today's debates.
And the central argument seems to come back to that idea of normality.
It does. The book basically says, look, sexual preferences, gusti, are personal, but the push to make minority behaviors, eccentricita, equal to the majority norm, normalita, is based on subjective perception, a social construct, not biological or statistical reality. He points to the vast majority identifying as heterosexual as defining the statistical norm.
And the book critiques what it terms ostentation.
Yes. Using examples like a military wedding video or pride events, it argues that the public display of minority behaviors can be unsettling to, well, common values. It also talks about a perceived gay lobby influencing media and politics, even while acknowledging that the existence of such lobbies is often denied. He attributes shifts in representation to this influence.
It also challenges the idea of gender being purely a social construct.
Strongly. The book emphasizes biology in defining gender and stresses the importance of distinct mother and father figures for child development, citing pediatric advice and personal experience. It argues against discarding these traditional models.
Which leads to criticism about how these themes are presented to kids.
Yeah, the book argues there's an overrepresentation of LGBTQ plus themes in media, fairy tales, movies, dolls. It frames this as an attempt to desensitize society from childhood, pushing a minority viewpoint onto the majority, potentially causing confusion, especially around gender dysphoria in young people.
It also touches on the friction between anti-discrimination laws and free speech.
Right. It brings up the U.S. Supreme Court case protecting a web designer's religious freedom refusal as balancing rights. Contrast it with an Italian case about refusing an apartment rental.
And a specific critique of hate crime laws.
The argument there is that creating special protected categories undermines the principle of everyone being equal before the law. The book asks why, for example, a homophobic insult should be treated legally different from insulting someone's football team. It defends freedom of expression very broadly, even for ideas seen as wrong, like flat earth theories, arguing that's foundational to Western progress. Criticizes what it sees as censorship by the politically correct.
Okay, Chapter X shifts focus again to cities. The new city.
This part critiques urban policies designed to get people out of cars. You know, 30-kilometer-rate speed limits, more traffic-restricted zones, ZTLs, replacing parking with bike lanes.
And the book sees these as ideologically driven.
Pretty much. Described as aiming for a more friendly, ecological, socially just city, but the book argues the result is mainly inconvenience, higher costs through fines, and less accessibility for people who actually need cars.
And the effect, according to the book, is changing who can live and work in cities.
That's the argument. That these policies turn cities from places for everyone, workers, artisans into playgrounds for the wealthy, officials, entrepreneurs, artists, making them unaffordable or just too difficult for others. Paris, under Anne Hidalgo, is used as a key example, citing debt, rat problems, and mobility changes seen as counterproductive.
Right. Okay. Last big theme we have time for. Chapter 12, the human-animal relationship. It critiques modern animalism.
Yes. The book takes aim at what it calls religious animalism or parlor animalism.
And the foundation of the argument is the distinction between humans and animals.
A fundamental distinction, yes. The book argues strongly against giving animals human rights or morality. Concepts like right-wrong, ethics, duties. These are human constructs, it argues, not found in nature. Uses the example of magpies attacking a chick that's instinct, not evil.
So it's pushing back against anthropomorphism.
Exactly. Attributing human feelings or motives to animals distorts reality, the book claims. Leads to things like dressing pets up or keeping animals cooped up in apartments, prioritizing human desires over the animal's nature. It even suggests intense animal love can sometimes be a simpler substitute for complex human relationships.
So what's the book's proposed approach?
Respect and preserve animals as part of creation, but always maintain the distinction and prioritize humans. Humans come first. It argues for moderate approaches. Regulated farming to minimize suffering, controlled culling for overpopulation, like wild boars, regulated hunting that can sometimes help ecosystems, necessary animal testing with oversight, and responsible pet ownership that doesn't impose on others.
And it dismisses some anti-culling argument.
Yeah, it mentions activist theories about animals becoming more fertile when threatened, or historical examples like Australia's Emu War, framing these as part of the world upside down, favoring questionable theories over practical solutions to real problems like overpopulation. Also critiques inconsistency, focusing on pets but ignoring insects, for instance.
Oh, okay. We've definitely covered a lot of ground there, all viewed through this lens from the General's book, this concept of the mondo al contrario, the world upside down.
We really have touched on its arguments about challenges to common sense, tradition, objective reality, across social norms, identity, safety, the environment, cities, even how we relate to animals.
And that common thread, as presented in the book, seems to be this deep concern about a shift where minority views or subjective feelings are felt to be taking precedence, maybe even being imposed, over majority common sense or established norms, often through social pressure or maybe inconsistent rules.
It's definitely a perspective grounded in a belief in objective truth and more traditional ways of seeing things as essential guides for society today.
Well, that brings us to the end of this particular deep dive, looking into the source material you provided, the General's book. Thanks for tuning in. As you think about the arguments presented here, in a world where common sense can sometimes feel, well, uncommon, and the lines between objective reality and subjective feelings seem to blur, how do you navigate this world upside down?